Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and thank you so much for listening to Idle Chatter. Ray Bohax here, as the intro said, the Hot Rod Farmer from the Farm Machinery Digest, and we're coming to you, as always, from Cat Swamp Road in Warren County, New Jersey. Cloudy, overcast, and let me look at the temperature, 42 degree Warren County. So I'm going to do my best to give you an interesting show, and we're going to talk today about carburetors. And as much as things change on the farm, right, there's some things that stay the same, like dealing with the weather, dealing with pests, dealing with the markets, dealing with everything else, equipment breaking down, and carburetors. I mean, even if you have the most modern operation with electronically fuel-injected gasoline engines, direct injection, and common rail diesel systems, tier 4 emissions, there is still carbureted engines floating around on the farm, and there always will be. So whether it's a carburetor that's on an old engine, an old grain truck, or an old irrigation pump, or a welder, or a compressor, or it is a newer piece of equipment, a seed tender engine, or a lawnmower, or a zero turn mower, what have you, there's always going to be the carburetor, not forgetting about small engines with carburetors like chainsaws, weed whackers, leaf blowers, and everything else that goes along with that. So I felt that it would be a good topic for us to discuss today on the show, because to me, I love carburetors. I've always loved carburetors, and I think that they are the essence of getting an engine to run properly. And I used to pride myself on fine-tuning all the carburetors I ever dealt with. And matter of fact, as a young man, when I was going to college, I worked in a Buick dealer out in Long Island, New York. So if you sense a little bit of an East Coast accent, it's a combination of New Jersey and for going to school out in Long Island. But anyway, I used to work in a Buick dealer, and it was called Reese Buick. And for some reason, I remember the address. It was 410 Jericho Turnpike in Mineola, Long Island. And I'm sure 99.9% of the people that are listening to this show today have no idea where Mineola, Long Island is, nor do they care. Actually, it was it still exists, thank God. It's a suburb of New York City, but it's out in Nassau County. So it's not physically part of New York City, but as in so many parts of the country, Nassau County, and then further out on the tip of Long Island, which was Suffolk County, that used to be all farms. And then as the city grew out of its limits into the suburbs, it became basically what we'd call on the East Coast a bedroom community, where people used to go there to sleep and go there to live, but they used to work in New York City, or closer to New York City. But that was Reese Buick, and I used to end up, I was a young guy, wet behind the ears, but I used to do all of the carburetor service there, and that was with the feedback carburetors, the electronic carburetors that GM had in the early 1980s to the late 1980s, and then also morphed into doing all their fuel injection work. And what we would call check engine lights, or they used to call computer work back then, right? Because it was a computer-controlled engine. So they used to call it computer work. I think the term computer work has something different to mean today than working on an electronic carburetor. But anyway, I used to pride myself on getting those carburetors to run perfectly. And I actually, you know, put myself through college doing a lot of side work and backyard work and having people come to me and be the tune-up man. So I guess before I was the hot rod farmer, I was the tune-up man. But I always took, and matter of fact, one of my first books was about carburetors. Well, not one of my first. My first book I had written was about carburetors, and it was about Demon carburetors. They were a competitor to Holley from down in Georgia. And that's actually how I met Vic and Susan Moore. And they are from Moore Good Inc. And Sue is the one who does my website, or created my website, farmmachinerydigest.com. And she's also working on a new website for Ripsaw Records. And Ripsaw Records is the one that, the label that Tex Rubinowitz, the hot rod man, that I use his music, about 21 seconds of his song Hot Rod Man, as the lead into the toolbox test each week. And Sue was working on a new website for Ripsaw, because they are the cutting edge of rock and roll, and their website needs to be updated. But anyway, that's how I met Vic and Sue Moore, as they worked for Demon Carburetor, and they also had a Demon at the time, which was owned by Barry Grant, which is now defunct. They were in Dahlonega, Georgia. So they were up in the hills north of Atlanta, and I think that there was an original gold mine in Dahlonega. So a little bit of history there, but that's how I met them. And then I was at a show called the PRI show, which is Performance Racing Industries. And I physically met Victor and Sue Moore there for the first time. We dealt over the telephone. And what had happened was that I was doing a nitrous oxide story for Hot Rod Magazine. Roe McGonigal was the editor back then. And I asked him, it was typical protocol when you worked with an editor, to ask them if there are any specific companies that he wanted you to represent as far as photography in the story. And there was a big company called NOS. And then there was a startup company, which was part of the Demon Carburetor line, Barry Grant's company, and it was called Nitrous Works. So he says, work with those two. So I called up NOS, Nitrous Oxide Systems, to get some photography for the article. And I also called up Barry Grant's company, Demon Carburetors, for Nitrous Works. And that's when I first spoke to Victor Moore over the telephone. And I told him I needed some photography and some information for this article for Hot Rod Magazine. Well, I think that was in 1999, maybe 2000. I think it was 1999. But anyway, arguably, let's say 2000, freeze your arithmetic. I'm still waiting to hear back from Nitrous Oxide Systems. And Vic Moore from was Johnny on the spot and got me great photography. And we actually used his photography in a story. And then subsequently, about 6 months later, I physically met them at the PRI show, as I was saying, which is Performance Racing Industries. That's actually the Hot Rod Industries version of something like Commodity Classic. It's not a huge, huge show. It's, I mean, 10 times bigger than Commodity Classic. But it's if it doesn't have anything to do with making the car faster, the engine, the brakes, the suspension, if it's not functional, it is not at PRI show. Whereas a show called SEMA, Specialty Equipment Marketers Association, has a lot of glitz and visual things for cars, but the Commodity Classic, the PRI show, did not. And then I physically was able to meet Vic and Sue at the trade show there, and then Sue came up to me and asked me if whether I was interested in ever writing a book, and I thought that she meant a novel. So I said, well, maybe one day, but really not. And what she meant is to write a book about carburetors, the Demon Carburetors. So in essence, that's how it all came together, is my first book, which is still being published and printed. And I think it's also available as an ebook. It's about Demon Carburetors. And I really enjoyed doing that because, as I said, I was always a carburetor man, because I think that the carburetor on any engine is like the conductor. It's not a one-to-one association, but it's a lot like the conductor of an orchestra. The conductor of an orchestra, which, believe me, I am not, brings all the instruments together. So it's not noise, but it makes beautiful music, whatever genre of music that you like. And then the carburetor brings all the elements of the engine together. to make it run properly and perform properly. And you could have a beautifully built engine, and if the carburetor is misadjusted or not correct, then that engine is not going to, the way it runs is not going to represent the beauty of its internal engineering, and also could offer the user, the end user, a lot of frustration. So I always felt that since I can't play any of the instruments, right, I might as well try to be the conductor. And I would pride myself, as I said a number of times already, that I would bring this all together. And the more adjustability a carburetor had, the more that I liked it. Because adjustability is a wonderful thing. It allows you to fine-tune and bring things together. So that's what we're going to be talking about today, is we're talking about carburetors. And I could actually do three or four shows on carburetors, but we're not going to belabor that. And what I will do is give you some idea of how a carburetor works, and then you would need to apply those ideas to the carburetor specific, the specific carburetor at hand. But I also want to give you some basic diagnostic procedures and also some basic adjustment procedures, because most of the time you will find that a carburetor, if it's clean and adjusted properly, will be a great, great, great part of the engine. And all, but it also will be a nightmare if it's just off a little bit. So that is what we're going to discuss. And then we're also going to have our toolbox test question later on. And we're going now into test number two. So we went through test number one. And keep in mind that those tests are on the website, farmmachinerydigest.com, and that they are all there, and they're multiple choice. So I'm actually going to be starting on test number two today, and it's going to be question number one from test number two. And then as far as the special delivery segment, which is concerned, I am going to follow up on a letter that I basically told you a little bit about last week from a gentleman up in Canada, from Ontario, and he has a older Ford Power Stroke diesel that he's having problems getting started. So we're going to go over that. And subsequently, I did communicate with him between last week and this week, and thankfully, he has it going and it's all fixed. So I'm going to do is share that information with you, and because I think that's a great learning tool. And somebody else's problems, right? Once they get fixed, they're a great learning tool. And, you know, as I started to say last week, I think I'm going to try to make this a weekly mantra in the show, because I feel that it's so important and it's so necessary for you as my listeners to be able to I don't want to say drill it into your mind, but to modify your thought process a little bit. And, you know, most times in life, things are just a thought process. It's really not much more than that, but recognizing something and seeing it and then responding to it, not just throwing your shoulders up and saying, oh, yeah, I see that. I see the nail in the tire, but I don't think that's where the flat, where the air is coming out. So to be ridiculous. But two things I do want to say to you, and it'll probably end up being three, right, as my mind goes on instead of two, is the first thing is that, you know, on any business, it's not what you make, it's what you keep. And I really don't see that mindset as prevalent in agriculture. And I'm sorry, but, you know, I tough love you guys, that I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear. And I tough love you. And I see that, you know, people are focused, and you're focused on everything but that. And it's, they focus on crop prices, they focus on yield. And like I say, your success on the farm or the ranch is a three-legged stool. It's basically, it's agronomy, it's marketing, and it's also your equipment. And I just really want you to remember that and think that. And most of the times when you have, not all the times, but most of the time when you have a premature failure in the shop with a piece of equipment, and that could either cost you a lot of money to fix or cost you very little money to fix, but it could also cost you, or probably will cost you, downtime. And as we all know, that agriculture is very, very sensitive, is a time-sensitive business, and farming is a time-sensitive business. So if we have something, it could be a $10 part, but if it sidelines a piece of equipment that you can't get in the field because of that, then that's really an issue. So how many times a few dollar part, or let's say even a $100 part, has cost you a lot of yield? And, you know, I really need to, you know, I'm going to drill that into you, because I honestly don't see that mindset being where it should be when I talk to people in the agricultural community. So that's the one thing. And, you know, the other thing that I wanted to say to you, which I started to introduce last week, is that this show, as you know, as you're listening to it, is an educational show. I tried to do my best to make it entertaining, to have education with an entertaining component to it. So it's just not drab and just, you know, a bunch of equations or what have you, like a physics class in high school or college. But the thing is that I ask you, and I'm going to give you some homework, right? The hope is that each week's show, take an element from the show with a basic overview of the show, and then go and then take that, what you've learned from this, and explain it succinctly and concisely to somebody else. And that is going to be the best way for you to learn. That's going to cement it in your mind like you would not believe. And that has to do with everything. It doesn't have to just do with my show. And I've said this before, but I'm afraid that people are not doing that. And I want you to learn and use. And if you learn this, then you will apply it. It'll become intuitive for you to apply whatever you learned in the show when you have a problem. You don't even have a problem in the farm shop, but you're maintaining a piece of equipment, you're thinking about a piece of equipment, you're looking to purchase a piece of equipment, what have you. So it's imperative that you do that. So your homework today is going to be to, in the next week, to explain to as many people as you can the basic function of a carburetor. And you don't have to go on for an hour. Even if you choose one or two or three different key elements from it, from the talk today, and explain that to someone, and you will see how that will make such a big difference in your understanding, and it'll be your go-to thing when you do have a problem. It'll be the trigger mechanism to think back at this show, or think back of, and you'll do the same thing. You read something in a magazine, you read something in a book, you watch something educational on a TV show, all right? The thing is that you watch a YouTube video. Then do the same thing. Take that and explain it. And I'm going to beat you to death with it moving forward, because I want you to do that. And I don't want you to have a laissez-faire attitude, because if you have a laissez-faire attitude about your equipment, I have never, ever seen a farm that was as successful as it should be. Now, it's not meaning that it was not successful, but as successful as it should be without efficiency as far as their equipment is concerned, with a minimal amount of breakdown, a minimum amount of failure, and as efficient operation as possible. So I've never seen it, because you could say, well, my neighbor down the road is very successful. Yeah, he's maybe very successful in yield and in marketing, but he's losing a lot of his success if he's not applying that same mindset to his equipment and all the things that are going on with it. So, all right, so be forewarned. You are going to be drilled. This is going to be drilled into your mind. All righty. So now it's time for us to finally, 19 minutes into the show, right? Like a pastor or preacher in church is, 20 minutes into the service and he doesn't even get to the topic yet. But anyway, but just know that it's done through a heart that wants you to learn and be successful. And there's no agenda other than that, than the success of the farm, the American farmer and rancher, and also those that are listening to the show from around the world. I want them to be successful also, no matter where they are farming. So just always remember that I'm a Marine drill sergeant. I'm going to be tough on you, because I want you to come back from the battle, and I want you to come back from the battle unscarred. I want you to be victorious. So, all right, let's talk about carburetors. But any discussion that has to do with carburetors needs to begin with gasoline. And because what does the carburetor do is that it ministers or feeds gasoline to the engine. So that's a very simplistic approach. And let's talk about three things that need to happen to gasoline before it becomes a suitable fuel for any engine. And I don't care whether it's a one-cylinder weed whacker or it's a V12, old GMC. In the 60s, they had the big V12 engines, and a lot of them were floating around in over-the-road trucks, and they were gasoline. They had multiple carburetors. They were kind of cool. They were two V6s put together. But anyway, so what we're talking about here is going to apply to any carbureted and gasoline engine. So the three things that need to happen to gasoline, just like the three things that need to happen on a farm, right, to be successful, the three things that need to happen to gasoline for it to become a suitable fuel for combustion is that it needs to be atomized, it needs to be emulsified, and it needs to be vaporized. And so many times I see people, they don't talk about emulsification much, but so many people seem to get atomization and vaporization confused and use those terms incorrectly. They are separate terms and they're separate things that happen to gasoline. So what does atomized mean? Well, you pump liquid fuel into the tank of an engine, gas tank of an engine, fuel tank, what have you, but the liquid fuel does not burn. So atomization means that you're taking this liquid fuel and you're breaking it down into small particles. So if you think of a spray can, or whether it's hairspray, right? I don't know, does anybody use hairspray anymore? Any women? But hairspray or a can of carburetor cleaner or even a can of Lysol or something. When they fill that can, that aerosol can, it's actually a liquid. You could take that can and you could shake it and you could feel the liquid and hear the liquid moving around. But when it comes out, it's in what's called an atomized form. So it's still liquid. So if you were to take the can of Lysol and you were to spray, let's say, the sink with it, right? It comes out and the sink gets wet. So what atomization is that it's a liquid and it's broken into very, very fine particles. And what we do is we talk about atomization to a certain extent when we are dealing with sprayer tips on a agricultural sprayer, right? And we say we want big droplets, you want small droplets. So what we're doing is we're defining the, I don't want to say the rate of atomization, because that's not proper, but we're defining the effectiveness or the end result of the atomization. So if you wanted something, if you're spraying and you want a large droplet, so let's say you're spraying with a large droplet because you don't want a lot of drift, then what's going to happen is that pintle, or the tip design, I'm using a fuel injection term, pintle, because I think engines, all right? So I think you'd probably know that by now. But the tip design of that sprayer is going to, they'll say it's a coarse droplet, it's a fine droplet, what have you. So that is the rate of atomization or the size of the droplet. So gasoline needs to be atomized, which means that it is broken into fine or small particles. And it's going to be atomized to a greater extent than the sprayer tip would be on a field sprayer, but that is still atomization. So now the next thing that needs to happen with gasoline is that it needs to be atomized, which is a liquid in fine, small particles, and then it needs to be emulsified. And in the term emulsification, when we're talking about carburetors, means that it needs to be mixed with air. So we have these fine particles that are still in liquid form, and they need to be mixed with air. So there's going to be air and liquid together, because what is an engine run on an air-fuel ratio? So we need to have the fine particles atomized, emulsified, mixed with air. And those two components, those two things that stages that happen to gasoline happen inside the carburetor. So the carburetor's main job is to atomize the fuel, and it needs, and its other job is, and if they're 50-50, they're just as important, it needs to emulsify the fuel, and it needs to take those smaller particles and mix it with air. And then the third thing that happens to fuel before it's a suitable fuel for combustion, it needs to be vaporized. And this is where people get atomization and vaporization confused. Vaporization means that it changes phase. PHASE, changes phase. And it changes from a liquid form to a rarefied, or what we would call a gaseous state. It has nothing to do with gasoline. That's why I often refrain from using the word gaseous state, unless I'm doing, let's say, a presentation where I could have a PowerPoint or something up on the board where I could show that. But it's a gaseous state, so it's rarefied. So what happens is that it has to phase change from a liquid to a gas. Not gasoline, a gaseous state, rarefied. a rarefied form. So if you look at it now, and we're going to back up. So the carburetor takes the liquid fuel, it breaks it into small particles, and then it mixes it with air, and now it needs to undergo a phase change. Now the job of the carburetor is only to mix the, break up the fuel, atomize it, and it needs to emulsify it. It is not responsible for the phase change. And the phase change is going to be controlled by the latent heat of vaporization. I'm going to have to clear my throat. Hello, I'm back. I had a, my sinuses, as I always tell you, and I feel badly about it because I'm always apologizing for it, but I got a coughing jag, and this button, as I said before, is not as efficient as I'd like it to be, as far as the pause button. So I apologize for the break in continuity of my lecture here today. And I will try to do my best not to have my throat give up on me again. So, alrighty, I'm going to stop this again for a second. I'm sorry about this. Hello, it's all right, I'm back now. Hopefully my throat is right. I apologize for that. And but anyway, so to get back to it, is that the phase change occurs through what is called the latent heat of vaporization. And for gasoline to phase change, it needs heat. And the actual phase change of the gasoline consumes the heat that is in the intake manifold. And that is why a carburetor needs a very rich mixture when the engine is cold. That's one of the main reasons why a carburetor has a choke, is because at 60 degrees Fahrenheit, the phase change of gasoline is only 50% effective. So 50% of the fuel is not phase changing. And then as the engine starts to run and build heat, and the temperature comes up in the intake manifold and in the cylinder head itself, then the phase change, you know, the phase change efficacy improves greatly. So the latent heat of vaporization is what takes the phase, or what creates the phase change of the fuel, not the carburetor. It's the carburetor's job to break the fuel into small particles mixed with air so there will be an efficient phase change. And for, and the phase change needs to happen for it to run, for an engine to run. Otherwise, the fuel itself is not going to ignite. So using that as our background, is that the carburetor, if it doesn't do a good job because it's not adjusted properly, doesn't do a good job of atomizing the fuel and emulsifying it, mixing with air, then the phase change will be very inefficient also, and the engine will run very poorly or may not even run. So that's the foundation of all carburetors, and I don't care whether it's a carburetor on an engine or if it's a carburetor on a weed whacker. So they all basically function the same. There is other elements of each carburetor that we have to discuss briefly. For instance, a lot of small engines, let's say like on a chainsaw or a weed whacker or a leaf blower, they do not have a float ball in the carburetor. What they do is they use the fuel tank as a float ball, and they have a line that goes from the venturi in the carburetor to a low pressure area to suck to draw fuel. And some of those carburetors are called vacuum jet carburetors, but they still function on the same thing. It's the carburetor's job being to atomize and emulsify the fuel. All right, so now that you have a basic understanding of how carburetors work, we will continue on. The thing is that what you need to do is that when you're approaching any carburetor and you're even doing any maintenance on an engine, what you need to realize is that cleanliness is next to godliness when it comes to carburetors, is that the carburetor needs to be kept clean. There's a magazine that I write for called Hemming's Muscle Machines. And it was a pet peeve of mine because they would photograph these beautifully restored muscle cars and the carburetor would be filthy dirty. I mean, it wouldn't be filthy dirty on the outside being grimy, but it'd be filthy dirty from the fumes of the gasoline turning to varnish and attracting dirt in the throttle bore, around the choke plate, around the air bleeds. Now, if you look inside any carburetor, you're going to have a jet, and it could be multiple jets, or it could be one jet, and the jet is actually what is going to administer the amount of fuel that engine needs to run. And the jet is based upon an orifice, a dimensional size that is drilled into that into it. So the size of the orifice, the passage in the jet, is going to determine how much fuel flows. And then if you look up around any carburetor, someplace around what we call the air horn or near there, and sometimes it's a little bit into the actual throat of the carburetor, there's little pinholes there. And those little pinholes, and like I said, makes a difference what kind of carburetor is, or what's called air bleeds. Now, what happens is the jet determines the maximum amount of fuel that the engine will be getting. All right, so it's basically like, you know, going back to a sprayer on a field. It's really not that much different. You say, okay, this is 30 gallons per acre at 45 pounds. This is 20 gallons per acre at 45 pounds, or whatever the pounds pressure you may be running. So that is the jet. The jet is going to determine the amount of fuel that is going to be supplied, whereas the air bleed is going to introduce the air into that fuel as far as the emulsification is concerned, and it is going to shape the fuel curve. So what happens is that you're not looking to design a carburetor. You're looking to maintain a carburetor and to get it to work properly. And the biggest problem with carburetors is that the throat of the carburetor down into what we would call the air horn and the throttle body of the carburetor gets varnished up and dirty, and the air bleeds, which are very, very small, the air bleeds get varnished up. They may not get plugged, but they get varnished up enough that they're in thousands of an inch increment sizes, that the orifice in the air bleed does not now flow enough air, and the emulsification process in the carburetor skews, and also the shaping of the fuel curve skews. And what I mean by the shaping of the fuel curve is that in most engines, the air-fuel ratio is not linear, is that you may idle at 14.7:1, and under acceleration may be down to 11:1, and then a wide open throttle may be 12:1, and then at closed throttle coast down it may be 16:1. So it's not linear, it's not the same all over. It's depending upon the operating state. So one of the biggest things that you could do to help your carburetor is to invest a couple of dollars in a can of carburetor spray. And I don't care what brand it is, they all seem to be as effective as the other, right? Carburetor spray, and then spray the carburetor, the inside of the carburetor, meaning down the throat, the venturi of the carburetor. Identify where the air bleeds are on that carburetor, and you'll see the little holes if you look in there. And sometimes they have little, they're actually little pressed in or drilled holes, and keep the carburetor clean. So a clean carburetor is like a clean, weed-free field. It's going to yield the most. So the most important thing that you need to do is clean the carburetor, right? You're going to clean the outside of the carburetor. You're going to clean the inside of the carburetor, and the inside meaning down the throat, right? And then you're going to maintain that. The next thing that you want to do is you want to make sure that that carburetor is snug, that all the fasteners are tight, that holds it together. Now, a carburetor is always a multi-piece carburetor. It could be a one-piece carburetor, two-piece carburetor, three-piece, four-piece, what have you. Is that you want to make sure these fasteners are snug, because you don't want any leakage. And it could be either fuel leakage or air leakage into a circuit, which is going to undermine its operation. So you want to keep the carburetor snug. And lots of times what you'll do if you have a three-piece carburetor, what you'll do is when it's on the engine, you'll take your hands and try to move it around. And you'll find that the screws on the bottom that hold what's called the throttle body, where the throttle plates are, to the float ball area, or the main body area, the top of the carburetor is historically called an air horn. Then you have either the main body or the float ball area, depending upon what the manufacturer called it. And then at the bottom is the throttle plate. So if you have a three-piece carburetor, for instance, like an old Rochester Quadrajet, it was very common for those bottom screws to loosen up. And if you would take the carburetor and grab it and you'd wiggle it around, you'd see that the air horn and the float ball would be moving around, and that the throttle body would be loose. so it's not loose to the intake manifold, it's loose to the other parts. So you want to do that, and you may have to take the carburetor off to tighten those bolts. If it's a three-piece, you will have to take the carburetor off. Alrighty, so you want to make sure that the carburetor is clean, that the carburetor is tight, and you want to make sure that the carburetor is tight to the intake manifold, and you also want to make sure that the intake manifold bolts that you could get to are snug. Now we're going to stick with the carburetor. So you clean it all over. You want to clean the linkage. You want to clean the choke linkage. You want to clean the butterfly. You want to clean down in the throttle bores. You want to spray it up good. Now, if it's a carburetor you've neglected and neglected up until this particular point and really didn't do a good job of cleaning it, you probably do want to pull that carburetor off so that you could clean up from the bottom the throttle plates from the bottom into the Venturi. But once you clean it well that way, if you maintain it and keep spraying it every once in a while, depending upon the use of the engine, every time you change the oil, do something, take the air cleaner off and spray the carburetor. This, you might do this on my lawn tractor, do this on my weed whacker, on my chainsaw. It makes no difference. You always want to try to spray that carburetor and keep, not try, you want to spray the carburetor and keep it clean. Now, the next thing that you're going to do is what I want you to do is now identify where the mixer screws are. So we have a clean carburetor and we're making sure that all the fasteners are tight. And they need to be snug. You're not going to moose them because the carburetor specifically, if it has a side hung float ball, which is a la like a Holley type of carburetor, but I don't want it. There's a lot of carburetors that you'll find that have side hung float balls that are not Holleys, and you may find them on an old farm tractor or what have you. But if the float ball is hung from the side, then what's going to happen is that you don't want to warp that float ball because it'll leak very easily. So you want to make sure all of the bolts are snug. And if you see any signs of varnish around a float ball, then you know that float ball is leaking and that either that gasket is corrupted or somebody moosed those bolts and warped that float ball, which is a problem. And the same token is that you could warp the air horn by over tightening the screws on the air horn to the main body or the float ball, like I said, whatever you want to call it. And depending upon the design, I'm just repeating that. And then if you have a float ball, air horn that is warped slightly, oftentimes the choke plate will bind and that carburetor will be a bear to start cold because it needs to choke to increase the amount of fuel because of the poor vaporization rate. Or the choke may close fine but not want to open up. And then it's causing a very rich fuel condition with the engine warm. And matter of fact, I sadly had that happen back in 2017. I bought a new John Deere lawn tractor for the farm over here with a Briggs & Stratton engine on a nice, great little machine. And it started up fine. I went to go cut the grass with it for the first time and I opened up the throttle and the thing is chugging and blowing black smoke and doesn't want to run and it says, what the heck is going on here? Brand new. And then I closed the throttle and it would idle okay, but it didn't idle great. It would idle okay. And then what happened, I looked at it, is that I had to, I guess when they built the carburetor, there must have been just enough tolerance in the air horn when they fastened it to the float ball that it was tweaked a little bit and the choke plate was binding. So when I pulled the choke to start it, the choke would close. But when I pushed it open, it wouldn't open all the way, even though the cable appeared like it was opening all the way from the dashboard of the tractor. So all I had to end up doing was loosening up the screws for the float ball slightly, which wasn't too bad to do, thank God. I tweaked it. I'm talking maybe a millimeter, if even that. It just settled into the gasket better, and I snug them back up, and it's been fine since 2017. So keep that in mind. You don't want to warp that. All right, so clean, tight, and then the next thing I want you to address is the mixture screws. Now, the mixture screw is going to be used. They're called idle mixture screws, and what you have to understand about a carburetor, it's a building block approach. What it does is it adds circuits upon it. So the idle circuit, even though it has the most authority at idle, as you start to tip into the throttle and as you start to put some load and some RPM into this engine, is that the idle circuit does not become fully negated. It's a stair step. It's a building block approach as far as fueling the engine is concerned. So for an engine to have proper throttle response and proper performance, it needs to have a properly adjusted idle circuit. And if it does not have a properly adjusted idle circuit, then what's going to happen is that you will have the foundation will not be there. And it will not only idle poorly, and it depends on how critical you are of your idle quality. As I said, I'm a stickler for idle quality. But you will not have what they call proper tip-in response as you start to open the throttle a little bit more. And then again, you know, if you look at a lot of small carburetors, like on a chainsaw, they don't have an intermediate circuit. They don't have a true main metering circuit. They have an idle circuit and they have a high speed circuit. And there's a mixture screw adjustment for both of those. And most of the time they have what they call limiter caps on them, where they have a plastic cap with a tang on it that you can only turn it so far. And that is supposedly for emissions, but I don't know if we'll get into that today. But what have you is that that's why usually they'll bog a little bit when you give it the throttle, because they don't have a transitional circuit, a main metering circuit into a power enrichment circuit, which is a automotive style carburetor that you would find on a car, truck, or an automotive type of application. Even if it's a car or truck engine on an irrigation pump, it'll have more circuits to the carburetor than a chainsaw or a weed whacker would, where they usually have just a low speed and high speed circuit. But it's imperative that you have the idle mixture adjusted properly. And we're going to go into that right now. Very, very simple. So we have a clean and tight carburetor. The next thing that I want you to do is, with the engine off, I want you to take the mixture screws. And it's usually, if it's more than a single cylinder engine, there's usually going to be two mixture screws. And I want you to gently seat them. And I want you to count the number of turns. So you gently seat them. You don't want to moose them, because it's going to be a pintle. It's going to be a needle against the seat. You don't want to warp it. So you gently seat them. You count the turns. So let's say arguably it's 2 3/4 turns to seat it from where the screw is. And that's only going to get you back to the point where you were, so that you knew that the engine ran. That's it. We're not going to go back there and stay there. We're going to just seat it, get you back to where you were. So now you're going to take the mixture screw, gently seat it. And now what I want you to do is take the mixture screw out. Now remember, there's going to be a spring on there, and the spring is on the mixture screw to hold it with tension so it doesn't change from a vibration. Now some mixture screws have a little tang that holds the spring on that doesn't let it fall off. Most of them do not. So you want to be very careful when you pull that, unthread that mixture screw, to hold the spring with your fingers so you do not lose it. And what you're going to do is you're going to take that mixture screw out with the spring. When you pull it out, hold it up so the spring doesn't fall off, all right? And I want you to take your spray carburetor cleaner, and I want you to spray into that mixture screw passage. And you're going to look down the throttle bore of the carburetor, and you're going to see the carburetor cleaner coming out. Even though you sprayed the carburetor cleaner, it's very possible that you have some varnish built up within that mixture screw passage, which is going to affect the way that fuel is atomized and then emulsified, and then bringing it home again with the phase change for it to run properly. So you're going to spray into that passage until you see, until you see a nice clear spray coming out. All right, you look down into the carburetor and see that. Now, okay, whether it's on a lawnmower or on a big engine, and you do the same thing. And then I want you to spray the mixture screw itself and clean it. And I want you to examine it both visually and tactily. I want you to take your finger and run your finger across it. If it looks kind of dirty or not shiny or corroded, I want you to take a very, very, very fine, and I like to keep an old piece of worn out green Scotch-Brite for this. The green Scotch-Brite, a piece of Scotch-Brite that's seen its better days. You don't want to take any material off that mixture screw, or you don't want to also gouge it. And you're going to take that Scotch-Brite or a very, very, very fine polishing cloth, and you're going to polish that mixture screw, and you're going to spray it again and clean it off. Then you're going to install it, you're going to seat it, then you're going to bring it back to whatever it was, 2 3/4 turns more or less. And then you're going to repeat that on the other side. Right, you're going to repeat that on the other side. And then what will happen is that you will now have a clean passage for that mixture screw, to administer the fuel, and the screw and the actual needle of the mixture screw will be clean and it'll be polished. And you're going to do that to both sides. And now what you're going to do is you're going to start the engine. It's going to be a little bit bulky to start because it has carburetor cleaner in it in the passages. You're going to rev it up a little bit. You're going to let it idle. And depending upon the application, what you're going to do, if possible, if it's a larger engine, you could hook up a tachometer to it. Then that'll be great. There's also there's tacks that you could buy, little clip-on tacks for one cylinder engines, which work great. They're not expensive. Alrighty, but if you don't have a tach available, what you're going to do is you're going to let the engine idle and you're going to adjust the idle speed so it's where it should be, because as you have to, the idle speed too high, you're going to take authority away from those mixture screws. So if those mixture screws don't change the mixture, it could be not only because the passages are dirty, it's because the idle speed is too high and you're starting to steal authority away from the carburetors transitioning from the idle circuit into the main metering circuit. And the thing is that you're very gently and very, very precisely, you're going to turn the one mixture screw in an eighth of a turn. And you're going to give it a chance to stabilize and you're going to wait. And what you're going to do is you want to qualify when the idle speed either starts to drop off or the idle quality starts to degrade. When you turn a mixer screw in, on 99% of the carburetors, you're leaning the mixture out. When you turn the mixer screw out, counterclockwise, you're richening it, giving it more fuel. All right, so you want to bring it in until you see the RPM, feel either audibly hear the RPM drop, or if you're watching a tach, and then you stop, and now you're going to take it and you're going to turn it out an eighth of a turn increments until you reach the highest RPM or the smoothest idle quality. If you had it really screwed up, then you're going to have to, now the RPM will be higher, the idle speed will be higher than you want, you're going to have to close the throttle plate back again and start all over again. So what you want to do is you're going to turn it in till the RPM degrades and the idle quality degrades, and you're going to back it out slowly, slowly, one mixer screw at a time, slowly until you get to the highest RPM and the smoothest idle quality. And then what you're going to do is you're going to, just to check it, to confirm your work, you're going to turn it in an eighth of a turn. You're going to see a slight drop in RPM, a slight degradation, idle quality. You're going to come back out and you're going to leave it and it's going to be done. And then you're going to go to the other mixture screw and do the same thing. So what you want to achieve is the highest RPM with the smoothest idle with the mixture screw, and that will get you the proper air fuel ratio for that application. So it's going to talk to you. What I mean by talk, it's like a dog wagging its tail or a cat purring. When you have the highest RPM and the smoothest idle from the mixture screw, you have it set perfectly, and you're going to go and do that to the other side. And the thing basically is the same thing is going to happen with a small carburetor. If you're adjusting the low speed and then you're adjusting the high speed, let's say on a chainsaw, you'll have the throttle wide open. Throttle will be different than on a pickup truck engine. Throttle wide open, and what you'll do is that you'll turn the mixture screw in until the RPM starts to degrade and the exhaust sounds farty, and then you'll turn it back out and you hear it still go, and you went too far, too rich, and then you'll bring it back until you get that sweet spot. And that is, in essence, how you adjust any carburetor. On a larger engine, I like to use a tune-up style tachometer so that I could see the RPM in 20 RPM increments. So that's an old tach and dwell meter. But if you don't have that, and if you have a good ear, and if you're patient, you could get it very, very close. I hate to use the word close enough for government work, but you could get it 99% that way. And that's what you would do to every carburetor. Now, keep in mind also, which we did not discuss this, is that the float level inside a carburetor is paramount to how all the circuits work. We're just talking about cleaning a carburetor and making an idle mixture adjustment. But the float level, if the float level is too low, then what's going to happen is that the throttle is going to need to be opened up more for it to start to pull fuel into the main metering circuit. You could have the float level too low, but it's not, it could idle beautifully, but it'll give you a sag or a bog as you start to open the throttle, what Ford called crowd the throttle. And then if the float level is too high, it could either dump fuel and you could lose authority from the mixture screws, or you can also pull over into the main metering circuit too soon. So let's say if the engine idles at 600 RPM, where it's not supposed to start to pull over into the main metering circuit to about 900 RPM, as soon as you open the throttle a little bit, it starts to pull fuel and dumps fuel and the engine runs too rich. So the float level, I'll do a show on float level maybe in a couple of weeks because it is important. But what I wanted to touch on today was just the idea is that probably from my experience, 95% of the carburetors, whether it's a hard starting issue, a lack of power, an idle issue, what have you, are because of cleanliness or a lack of cleanliness, there a lack of the fasteners being tight and the idle mixture screws misadjusted. So over my years of over 30 years of working on carburetors, many carburetors I've worked on, people thought they were junk and it was the thing ran like a bag of bolts and all needed to do was be cleaned and need to be cleaned, snugged up to stop any internal leakage and then adjust it properly and they would swear that it was a different carburetor or a different engine. So that is what I wanted to touch on today. So remember the key talking points for you to explain to someone in the next week and on there is how does a carburetor work? A carburetor needs to atomize the fuel, which is take liquid fuel, break it into small particles, emulsify it, mix it with air, and then once it's atomized and emulsified, because when it's atomized, it has more surface area, right? Because there's little droplets, so there's more surface area for all the fuel molecules, and then it needs to phase change, which is vaporize, and the phase change works upon the latent heat of vaporization and needs heat for it to phase change from a very small particle liquid atomized into a gaseous or rarefied form, which is what the engine needs to burn. And the air bleeds are responsible for the emulsification process and also for shaping the fuel curve. And oftentimes they just get dirty or gummed up and just need to be cleaned. You're not re-engineering the carburetor, you're cleaning the carburetor. But I cannot emphasize enough that the carburetor, a clean, tight carburetor with the properly adjusted mixture screws is probably, like I said, 90-95% of the problems. And I don't care whether it's a small engine or a big engine, all right, the thing is that it all comes into play. So it's, you know, to do those things, you'll find it's very easy. Invest a couple of bucks in a can of spray carburetor cleaner, keep the carburetors clean, keep them tight, and you'll be surprised how well they will run. So now we're going to get ready. And as always, if you have any questions or any concerns, please feel free to contact me at the Hot Rod Farmer, the Farm Machinery Digest.com. I mean, Hot Rod, excuse me. Hot Rod Farmer, yeah, Hot Rod Farmer, Farm Machinery Digest.com. I don't even know my own email address anymore. Alrighty, but now we're going to get ready to go into our toolbox test. And our toolbox test is brought to us proudly by Agro Liquid. They are perfectly calibrated crop nutrition, superior quality, superior delivery, and superior results. And I can attest to that because we are an Agro Liquid farm. And the difference that I have seen in my marketable yield and the drought tolerance and the disease tolerance by switching to a complete Agro Liquid program has really been, you know, day and night difference. So I ask you to please check out Agro Liquid. Go to their website, agroliquid.com, talk to their representatives, and if you check them out, I know that you will become an Agro Liquid customer. And the thing is that if you check them out and look into it, you will see what I saw. And you don't need to be an agronomist. You'll just know what is good and neat, and you need to become an Agro Liquid farm. But they have bringing us our toolbox test question today. But before we do that, we're going to have to hear from my good friend, Mr. Rubinowitz. And Tex Rubinowitz, my good friend, I got tongue-tied here. Good friend Tex Rubinowitz and the Hot Rod Man song. So here it comes. Enjoy it.
Well, I'm a rolling daddy with a mean machine. It's got a V8 motor and it sure is clean. I'm a Hot Rod Man. Yeah, I'm a Hot Rod Man. Well, look out, little mama, gonna get you if I can.
Hey, Tex, thank you so much for singing that for us. You know, here it is with this new soundboard. I'm controlling things that I'm not used to controlling. I kind of get myself in a tizzy here. But, you know, that is, as I said, Tex Rubinowitz, Hot Rod Man, found on Ripsaw Records, the cutting edge of rock and roll, who soon will have a great new website. And I'll invite you to come there at that particular point. Don't go there now because it's not up. And then you could check out all of the great rockabilly and other songs that they have on that from the old days. Alrighty, toolbox test. All right. You are thinking about investing in another self-propelled sprayer for the farm. You do not want to buy a new one since this unit will only be used for foliar feeding and fungicide application. You had a bad experience a few years back when you seriously dinged up and killed some crop due to herbicide residue. You vowed to yourself to eventually get a dedicated sprayer for in-season crop care and nutrition. You found a nice unit a few towns away. The seller said that it worked well until recently when the pressure would not stay steady. He felt it needed a new pump and priced the sprayer accordingly. You agreed with his diagnosis and took the unit home. Upon removal and disassembly of the centrifugal-style pump, you noticed the housing was pitted internally and the tip of some of the impeller fins broken off. Confident that you found the issue, you bolted on a new pump and hit the field, only to find that the same pressure problem exists. Perplexed and frustrated, you ask around for some advice, and this is what you receive. Farmer A says the new pump is defective and has the same problem as the one you replaced. Farmer B believes that the gauge is wrong and the old pump was fine. Farmer C says that the old pump ate some dirt from the tank and it must still be in the system. That is why the impeller is damaged and the volute pitted internally. Farmer D is adamant that the original pump was damaged by cavitation, and that is why the pressure is jumping around. So just remember, don't remember whether it's A, B, C, or D, who is right, what is wrong with that pump, and why are those problems still there. Alrighty, so we will get to that in a couple of minutes, but first is going to be our special delivery segment brought to you by Firestone Ag, a company founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar design, AD2 technology, and now the Firestone of replacement tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm, trusted only to Firestone, and I believe that wholeheartedly. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. All right, so now we're going to get to Mr. Cowenberg's letter. And hopefully I didn't kill his name like I did last week. So we're going to read his letter, and we're going to go from there. Let me just get this letter out over here. Okay, and we're going to... I listen to your podcast while running a sprayer and combine and find it very informative. And useful. My question to you is that I have a 1997 Ford F-250 with a 7.3-liter turbo diesel engine. I found over the last couple of months I began to have issues starting my truck after it's been sitting for a while, anything longer than 4 or 5 hours. Because I live in Ontario, Canada, I figured it was because of the slightly colder weather now and that some of my glow plugs had failed. They were about 6 years old. I replaced all of the glow plugs and the valve cover gasket. All of the wiring and harnesses looked to be in good condition. Everything worked perfectly for a couple of weeks, and now I'm having a crank no start problem. The truck cranks over quickly and doesn't even try to fire up. A little bit of gray smoke comes out of the exhaust, but not much. If I give it a little shot of ether, it will fire right up and run perfectly smooth, at least for an old 7.3. The truck has 430,000 kilometers on it, and I can't figure out if it's fuel-related issue or possibly a cam sensor issue. The truck has only shut off once when I was driving, and that was 4 or 5 years ago, so I don't think it is the sensor. I'm thinking it is fuel-related issue. Also, after I started with the shot of ether, I can shut it off almost immediately, and it will then start up with no problems. Thanks for your advice, and keep up the great work with the podcast. Thank you, Simon. Well, I was able to communicate with him, and we went back and forth in email, and I did make some suggestions to him, and I felt that, and I think that he kind of fixed it on his own before I got my suggestions to him, sadly. But what ended up happening was the truck had a failed glow plug relay. He had told me that and that was one of the things I said to him, to make sure that you are checking that the power supply to the glow plug is strong enough to light off all the glow plugs. And the glow plug relay was melted internally, and so it was starving the glow plugs from the proper amperage for them to heat up enough for the truck to start. So, you know, the take-home message here is, you know, always, and I'm glad, thankfully, he said it starts fine now, so I'm glad that that is working well, and got kind of cold up in Canada the past couple of weeks, so I know that that is, that's a good test. But the, you know, the take-home message here is to, with anything electrical, and especially a high amperage demand like the glow plugs, you need to confirm that it's getting full power and has a good ground. And in this particular instance, what we need to do is throw away the fact that when he changed the glow plugs, that it worked for a week or two and started fine. When you're chasing electrical issues, lots of times you can't apply that to it. Now, what may have happened is that the glow plug relay could have been on the way out. He had some weak glow plugs that weren't pulling the full amperage demand. And then with the new glow plugs, all 8 glow plugs that were working properly, it overloaded the relay because the contacts were starting to burn already, and that did it in. Or that could have nothing to do with it whatsoever. So what I want you to realize is that oftentimes when you're working on electronics like this or electrical circuits, what you'll need to do is you will have to go in there and confirm voltage, amperage, and ground depending upon the circuit. You know, because if you said to yourself, well, why did it work for 3 weeks or 2 weeks or 1 day and stop working, and it'll put you down the wrong diagnostic path. So I'm very glad that he got it working, and always, you know, go to the low hanging fruit first. I'm sure if he would have checked the resistance of some of those glow plugs, that the original problem was that the glow plugs were starting to burn out and they were not getting hot enough, quick enough, and that is why the truck was hard starting. And then I think that the relay was also starting to go bad on him, and then what had happened is the contacts were starting to burn inside and not carrying the full amperage load. And then what happens is that he put the new glow plugs in, it only had 2 or 3 or whatever, a number of starts in it, probably more than 2 or 3, and then the relay gave up the ghost, and he was back to where he was, but he was back to where he was for a different reason. All right, for a different reason. So when you're chasing electrical stuff, you know, keep that in the back of your mind. Why did they change this and it's working fine and it stopped working fine? You know, keep that in the back of your mind. It's a good indicator. It's a good indicator of what's going on, but it cannot be the only indicator. You have to apply actual values to what's going on. And it's just, you know, without applying values to electrical circuits is akin to like trying to diagnose crops without doing a tissue test or a sap test or a soil sample or what have you. And as I always say, once you see it like that, it's really bad. And there's a number of different, as you all know, the number of different crop nutrition deficiencies that present almost alike, and the same thing happens with electricity. So we need to actually apply things to it. I'm glad that he did apply to it and find that the glow plug relay was failed, and was burned internally. Obviously, he took it apart, which is great. That's what I like to do. Find the smoking gun. Don't just plug a new relay in and say it starts great now and go on. I always am a big, big proponent of forensic investigation with failed parts. So listen, I want to thank you so much for listening to the show today. I hope that you enjoyed it. As I always say, is if you have any questions or any issues or concerns, if I could help you in any way, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And I want to tell you that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved, beloved America. You have a blessed week. Take care. Hopefully you listen next week. Thank you.